And welcome to Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live here on Giants.com. He is Paul Dottino. I'm Lance Menno with you for the next 60 minutes. Thanks so much for tuning in. Two ways for you to interact with us here on the program, 201-939-4513, hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter. There are two articles up on Giants.com in which two Giants players have received honors from NFL.com, so we want to cover that. The deadline, or I should say the date to start giving out the franchise tag and the transition tag is Wednesday. There could be a few Giants that are taken into consideration for that. Kirk Cousins of the Redskins, we'll get into some of that. Mm-hmm. And we'll get to your phone calls, we'll get to your tweets. Let's start with the Giants news first. NFL.com through Gil Brandt gave out its all-rookie team for the National Football League this season, and Eli Apple of the Giants was named as one of the corners for that team. And Gil Brandt put forth the fact that Eli Apple started a number of games, showed his versatility, and only missed one game because of injury, but had been fairly consistent, so that was nice to see him be recognized.
Well, when you consider the last half of the season, I think he played over 90% of the snaps as he was on the outside, and, you know, DRC played inside in the slot for the whole season. Look, the only reason the Giants were able to do that, and think of how much better this secondary was because of their three-headed cornerback situation. We know what Janoris Jenkins was, or at least the Giants knew when they signed him in free agency. We thought he'd be more of a gambler. Turned out he was just great. But even if you say, okay, fine, he's going to hold down one corner. Look, if Eli Apple didn't come in and have a solid rookie season and prove to the Giants from the very get-go that he would be an NFL-caliber player right away, they couldn't have toyed with moving DRC to the inside. They would have said, oh, this rookie's not ready. We saw some things in the spring and the summer. Didn't make us feel too comfortable. We're going to have to keep DRC outside. This idea of moving him inside is not going to work. We're just going to have to keep him on the outside. And you know what? Eli Apple, we're going to work you in. And who knows how much he would have played had he not made a good impression
maybe
during
just special
camp.
Teams.
He might have been. Or he might have been the nickel corner in the slot. Or maybe he would have just been the nickel corner who plays outside and DRC would have slid down into the slot exclusively on passing downs. There are a lot of ways they could have played this if Apple was not ready for full-time duty. But because he proved immediately out of the gate that he was ready to play NFL caliber football, the Giants became better at two positions because they not only enhanced one corner by signing Janoris Jenkins, but now they dramatically enhanced the slot by putting DRC in there because Apple was able to hold the fort on the outside.
Well, it gave him some versatility in the secondary as well, so that was obviously big for
Eli
Apple to perform the way he did. Just to set the table here, the other two corners that made the team, Vernon Hargraves of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, he actually went in the position right after Eli Apple, if you recall, in the first round of the 2016 draft. He was 11th overall, Apple was 10th, and then Jalen Ramsey, the 5th overall pick for the Jacksonville Jaguars, was the third corner. So that is who represented the all rookie team at that position. The other Giants-related news is related to another member of the Giants secondary, and NFL.com put together its top five players, kept it general in that sense, for the 2016 season. Any position, any player.
Right.
Landon Collins was the only defensive player to make this group of five. I think it speaks volumes of how everyone has looked at the jump he made from his rookie campaign to his sophomore campaign. The other four players, running back David Johnson of the Arizona Cardinals, Le'Veon Bell, the running back of the Steelers, and then two quarterbacks, Tom Brady and Matt Ryan, who both made the Super Bowl. So Landon Collins, who's still a young player in the NFL.
Yes.
I mean, they could have went with a veteran defensive player on this list, Paul.
Well, you know, the interesting part for me is that at the NFL Honors, he finished third in the Defensive Player of the Year voting. And it seemed as though, and I got no arguments with Khalil Mack.
I mean, I think he had a pretty good season the last
really,
time I checked.
Really good.
Yes.
Okay. I understand that the sack masters will usually get that scale weighted in their favor. I get that. But NFL.com decided, you know what, we're going to bypass the sack specialists. You know, Von Miller, Khalil Mack. They're not going to be ahead of Landon Collins. We think that Collins had a big impact on the Giants and a big impact on the NFL, and he was going to be the only defensive player in the top five. I do think that speaks volumes for him, and it says a lot about not putting the overemphasis on the sacks.
Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks were the two individuals from NFL.com that put this top five together. Now, the things that they notate as to why Landon Collins made this list, and it goes back to your point, they didn't emphasize one particular facet right. of what a player does. They were looking for somebody that chips in and contributes every which way. And they noticed that Landon Collins tackled well, forced fumbles, off the edge was able to blitz, got interceptions. I mean, he gets the check marks in a variety of different departments, whereas if you pick a Khalil Mack or a defensive end, you know, maybe you get the forced fumbles, maybe you get the sacks, but you don't necessarily get the interceptions or the tackles in the open field and so forth.
You know, if I may, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here, you guys know that often during the season, former Giants do kind of come around and speak to some of the young guys and kind of, I don't want to say act as a big brother, but there are some guys around here who are looked up to by the current players. And one guy in particular who was an influence and a help to Landon Collins was Deion Grant, who was a very cerebral player and became a key leader on, you'll recall, the Giants Super Bowl run, you know, about 10 years ago. And Deion really, really watched closely Collins' rookie season. And I had many talks with him during that off season about what Landon Collins brought to the table and how he could get better. And I know that Deion Grant, who does spend a lot of time up here around the Giants, he does visit often. He went out of his way to make sure that he met with Landon Collins many a times and tried to impart whatever he could to help this player along. And I think that if we had Landon in the room right now, he would tell you that that's a heck of an influence to have on a young safety.
Absolutely. Also somebody that's familiar with the organization and what they need from that position.
Sure.
With Steve Spagnuolo's system
right.
and so forth. I mean, that's the big key, too. There were certainly a number of factors why he made a significant jump. More so that happened on the field, the personnel he played next to, familiarity with
no
the
question.
Scheme. But I think you brought up an interesting point, the fact that also talking to current and former players who are associated with the Giants organization to know exactly what you need to do within the realm of the scheme certainly chipped in and contributed to why Landon Collins had a very, very productive season. So Landon Collins, Eli Apple, with some recognition on NFL.com. We'll get more into that. We'll get your reaction on that moving forward here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. For those of you watching on Twitter, we invite you over to Giants.com to watch the remainder of the program. Lance Beddoe, Paul DeTito with you here on Big Blue Kickoff Live, Monday's edition, as we start up a fresh week here on the Giants website. And we're going to get to your phone calls at 201-939-4513, hashtag Giants Chat on Twitter, as the accolades continue to come the way of the New York Giants. It was interesting. I just want to get back to Gil Brandt's all-rookie team list, and we talked about this off the air, Paul. It seemed, based on Gil's rationale, that he took into consideration even how these rookies performed, those of them, of course, that made the playoffs, what they did in the postseason, because it was interesting that Sterling Shepard did not make the list.
Right.
And it was Malcolm Mitchell of the New England Patriots who got the other wide receiver spot next to Michael Thomas, who I think we both agree had a very productive season
yes.
for the Saints. But, you know, you could certainly make a case for Shepard over Malcolm Mitchell when you look at the numbers, but Mitchell by far outperformed Shepard in the postseason.
Well, that's true. Shepard had the one game against Cleveland where he was not targeted, and only one other game during the course of the regular season when he caught less than three passes. So he was consistently a part of the Giants offense from start to finish. Mitchell, of course, came on stronger at the end and then had a very good January, afforded the opportunity to go to the Super Bowl and made some grabs in that game also. And so it does seem to us, based on the comments by Gil Brandt, that that was a part of his decision. And you know what? If you want to more heavily weigh the postseason, you certainly have a right to. Those are the most important games of anybody's year. You could make the argument that Mitchell certainly deserved a lot more credit than maybe some people would have had they only voted at the end of the regular season.
Well, as you mentioned, he had a very productive Super Bowl performance, and also he was extremely efficient for a player that wasn't heavily used early in the season. 48 targets, 32 catches of those 48 targets. Now, Shepard was much more heavily used by the Giants. He was targeted over 100 times and wound up catching 65. 105 was the exact amount of targets, caught 65. You threw out his consistency throughout the course of the season, but obviously Mitchell came on late And that's what I think maybe gave him the edge, and also obviously the Patriots winning the Super Bowl did not necessarily hurt his case as well.
You know what I'd love to see, and I don't know if it's going to happen or not. We do think the arrow is up on Sterling Shepard, but could he improve to the point that Landon Collins did in year two? That would be spectacular if he could really jump up that high in his second NFL season. I think that's a bit much to ask, quite frankly, because Collins went from being a rookie to being a Pro Bowl player. I don't know that Sterling Shepard's going to be a Pro Bowl player in the fall of 2017, but I think he's got ups. I think we're going to see more out of him in terms of big plays. I really do.
I think they realize that he's comfortable in the slot. He can be productive there as a good complement to Odell Beckham. But, you know, the other reason why I think it's going to be difficult is Landon Collins, remember, as we've talked about on this program, Paul, had his fair share of ups and downs during his rookie campaign. Shepard, I don't necessarily look at it the same way. Not to say that there's not room for improvement with Shepard, but I think with Shepard, there was a better grasp of what they needed from him within the offense. Whereas if you're going
to look for... Easier position to play.
Correct. Well, that's another big reason. So if you're going to look for a noticeable jump, I don't know if there's room for that noticeable jump. I mean, clearly his numbers could go up, his targets could go up, but Collins was thrown right into a baptism by fire situation.
He really was.
He had to start as a rookie. It's a difficult position, as you noted, and he also had a revolving door of players next to him.
No question.
There wasn't that continuity like Shepard had with other wide receivers like Beckham and Cruz next to him consistently. So, once again, I just don't think the gap is as big for Shepard entering his sophomore campaign as what Collins was looking when he was entering 2016.
Yeah, you know, I think the Giants offense as a whole is hoping for an uptick, obviously, this fall, and Shepard will just be part of that. At least that's how I anticipate it. I do think that the one thing that he will get stronger, first of all, remember, he's not a real big guy, and coming right out of school, he played bigger than he was, but he will get stronger in year two. And in year three, as he matures into his full-fledged NFL career. Right now, he's still kind of a newbie, you know? So I think getting stronger is physically one thing he can do. I don't think the speed will change. I think, you know, his moves and his quickness, that's what it is, and no complaints here about that. But I think he will get stronger, and that may help him break free a little bit easier, may help him break tackles and get more yardage after the catch, potentially. And it may even help him fight for more balls, those 50-50 balls. Yeah. As he gets stronger, he may get after those a little bit better. So those are the kinds of things you want to see from him in this fall, and perhaps even, because he was a good route runner already, perhaps even become a better route runner too.
Well, for a player that's 5'10", and you just alluded to this, I mean, he's got ups for a player who is not necessarily the tallest player out there when you look at a personnel standpoint. And I think that there were times where, you know, there were some of those 50-50 balls, and I'm sure Eli Manning felt, you know what, if I throw it up there, Shepard's going to give me a chance for that ball to be completed. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, you know, his route running, which, you know, I think most people were rather complimentary across the NFL. I know that, you know, even when they analyzed him on NFL.com, because there was a separate list where they put together the top 10 slot wide receivers in the NFL, Paul.
I didn't
and
see
Shepard
that one.
Actually made that list.
Did he?
For the top 10 slot wide receivers in the
Good
NFL.
Good job by him.
And one of the things that jumped out to them when they were putting the list together was the route running. More so than any other facet of his game, they were impressed for a rookie to be that smooth in terms of his transition, understanding a variety of routes out of the slot.
Good stuff.
That obviously was something nice to see. But overall, you know, for the young players, and this is the bigger theme, the draft class overall, what they got out of the 2016 class, when you look back, that's what you now want to do again in 17. You want to continue to build mm-hmm. upon this young nucleus.
Yeah, you know, I told people going into last season, you know, the Giants may have needed as many as 10 different replacement parts that would produce for them to be a playoff contender. They got, what, good 6-7 parts that got them into the playoff conversation and then forced their way into the wild card situation. I think now, what do they need? 3 or 4 more parts to now become not only a playoff team, but a real championship conference or conference championship contender this fall. They're well beyond the halfway point to getting where they want to be, I think, after winning 11 games this past season.
Well, if you just look at the Falcons as a blueprint, the team that just represented the NFC in the Super Bowl, Paul, The Giants' defense is much better than Atlanta's. I don't think there's really any debate. The Giants have much more continuity and strengths at various positions.
Well, they're a top 10 defense.
Correct.
No matter how much you want to argue against some of the things that you could nitpick on, they're a top 10 for sure.
So then the better comparison, if you're to look at the Giants or the Falcons, is on the offensive side of the ball. And what did Atlanta have that helped them get to the Super Bowl? Well, good offensive line play. Much more continuity and consistency.
Power running game.
Power running game, too. And a little bit more versatility out of the backfield in terms of what the running backs could do as receivers. And also a wide variety of targets for Matt Ryan. And not that the Giants didn't have that, but I guess guys that you knew could consistently make plays. And beyond the Odell Beckhams, the Shepherds, and the Victor Cruises. The fifth, the sixth, the seventh guy in the Falcons offense, Paul, was pretty much just as reliable as maybe the third option.
Well, you know what I like to say when people talk about how guys spread the ball around or how a coordinator likes to get everybody involved? That's all well and good, and that's a positive for your offense. I agree with that. But the real trick is like what the Patriots do. It's not how many guys can you get involved in a given game. It's how many different guys can actually step up and be the featured guy in a winning performance.
Absolutely.
That's different than saying I'm going to pass the ball to eight guys on Sunday. No. Each and every week, there might be a leading receiver over the course of a month. That's a different thing entirely than just saying we're getting everybody involved.
But I would argue the more you get the personnel involved, the better prepared you are for that player to have a breakout game.
No argument
at all. So that when, for example, Julio Jones gets hurt, which actually happened with Atlanta this season, right?
Yes.
He missed two games with the turf toe injury. So Julio Jones goes down, and the Falcons are saying to themselves, well, we've got Mohamed Sanu. We've got Taylor Gabriel, who had a nice breakout campaign. We have two running backs. We have multiple tight ends. And they were able to get by with Julio Jones out of the lineup. Why? Because those other players, to me, and this is my opinion, were heavily involved over the course of the season leading up to Julio's injury. Whereas if you're top-heavy on your depth chart, Paul, and you rely on one or two guys, when they go down, if you didn't get the others involved, the fourth, fifth, sixth option, are you then preparing your team week 8 or 9 when your star guy goes down? Can that player make that big jump that you're referring to?
Well, let's look at it this way. And you guys know how big a fan I am of Paul Perkins. But Paul Perkins was not going to be able to carry the load against Green Bay in that playoff game like James White carried the load for the Patriots by scoring 3 touchdowns in the Super Bowl. Okay? Perkins, as a rookie and as a third-day draft pick, was not prepared, and this is not a knock on him, but his role in the offense, his experience, the amount of things they relied on him upon were not going to be conducive to him being the lead offensive guy in a postseason game. But James White for the Patriots, he was the third most targeted running back in the league this year. And even though most people in Vegas probably didn't think he would be the number one offensive player in the Super Bowl, you bet your darn straight that Bill Belichick knew all along going into the game that James White's going to be my X factor.
They love those matchups, and they love to highlight different players. Deion Lewis against the Texans, Chris Hogan against the Steelers,
That's my point.
In the Super Bowl.
Not just that they're involved, but that different guys can become the featured guy. That's the real difference.
Well, but then I still go back to the fact that those players that we just named, though,
they have to be involved in the first place.
Yeah, correct. They have to be involved
no
early.
Question.
Now, Lewis, he was hurt for the majority of the season, but Lewis had played previous years. He wasn't a rookie, and same thing with Hogan, has some NFL experience. Now, before we head to the phone lines at 201-939-4513, we'll also get to some of your tweets at #GiantsChat. The franchise tag and the transition tag, you can start giving those out this Wednesday, February 15th, and then you have all the way to March 1st to decide whether or not you want to utilize that. So that is obviously going to be a relevant, newsworthy story this week as teams start to determine whether or not they want to hand it out. And Kirk Cousins is probably going to be one of the top candidates who you're going to hear a lot about, the Redskins quarterback. And then, obviously, the Giants have JPP and Jonathan Hankins, who they may consider using those tools if need be. But we just wanted to throw out the dates, at least, so you're aware of what's coming up with respect to the NFL calendar. We'll get a little bit more into the nuts and bolts of what those tags are about as we move forward here on Big Blue Kickoff Live. In the meantime, let's open up the phone lines. We got Mark in Chicago to get us going on Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. Mark, how's everything?
I'm doing well, guys. How are you?
Doing well, Mark.
Hi.
What do you got for us?
Well, I'll tell you, your conversation about James White, I was not surprised at his performance in the Super Bowl. I picked him up in my fantasy league about midway through the season, and every time he was made the featured back, that guy really produced. The problem from a fantasy standpoint was you never knew if he was going to be the featured back.
And that's what we're talking about.
Flip of the coin. Yep.
Yep. So I really appreciated your all of your guys' analysis of the Super Bowl last week, and brought up a couple of questions in my mind. Everyone has been talking about how Kyle Shanahan made some questionable calls. Now, I went back and looked at the fourth quarter of that Super Bowl, and I thought his calls on that third and one play and that second and 11 play, I wouldn't say they were just questionable. I thought they were very arrogant calls. I mean, if you look at the formation that they were in, a shotgun formation, open backfield, they'd made no attempt to disguise a run. And I think the Patriots saw that, and they're like, hey, we're going after them. And look what happened. So it brings me back, actually, to Ben McAdoo. I sort of put McAdoo in the same category as Kyle Shanahan. I don't really think in their DNA they really like to run the ball. They like to pass. And I guess my question is, does Ben McAdoo, when he's watching that game, and I'm assuming he's watching the game, does he sit back and look at that and say, man, if I ever get caught in that situation, I'm not going to do what this guy did? You know, I've never been around a head coach in the NFL. What's their thought process when they look at things like that?
Well, I mean, I think you use everything you see on film as a learning experience, whether it be from your own team or another team that took part in the big game. But, you know, I think something that's also relevant to what you're bringing up, Mark, is the fact that, I don't know if you remember, in overtime, before the Patriots got the game-winning rushing touchdown with James White, they're on the goal line, and Tom Brady throws a pass intended for Martellus Bennett, which is nearly intercepted. And it was ironic because it brought me back to the Seahawks game when Seattle was criticized for throwing the ball. So you would say under those circumstances, well, didn't Bill Belichick and Josh McDaniels learn from a team they went up against a few years ago in the Super Bowl?
Here's the difference. Here's the difference. The fade route in the corner of the end zone, although it was not a great pass and certainly was defendable, the chances of that getting picked off much less than the ball that's near the numbers.
I get that. Yeah. You're talking about the Russell Wilson.
Yes.
But still, it's still a risky situation when you have plenty of personnel in the backfield and you have moved the ball down the field with ease, and Atlanta hasn't done anything to stop you.
I thought it was a risky pass myself.
I cringed when I saw that.
Not nearly as dumb as the Russell Wilson.
Well, listen, I don't think any play is necessarily dumb because you're not going in thinking that you're going to get an interception. You're going in thinking, listen, we practiced this play. It's a strong play. We're going to execute it. So I wouldn't go that far, but I would just say the percentages are higher. You've been moving the ball on the ground. Give it to your running back at least on first down and try to punch it in. So, I mean, Mark, getting back to your question, yes, you use it as a learning experience, but, you know, everybody has their own offensive philosophy. And the other thing that I wanted to add, you know, you brought up Kyle Shanahan not liking to run the football. Keep in mind, you know, he coached under his father, Mike, and when Mike coached in Denver, you know, the Broncos produced 1,000 rushers like that. I mean, they would pull these guys off the street. Mike Anderson, for example, ran for 1,000 yards. He wasn't necessarily a household name. I'm talking about after Terrell Davis. So he actually comes from a blueprint where they actually do like to run the football with the zone blocking scheme. I don't know necessarily if I would generalize and say they don't want to run the football. Plus, Atlanta was very effective in running the football this season. They had two versatile backs who they pounded the ball with.
Well, on their first down play, they picked up 8 yards. That's how they got to a second and one and a third and one. And I don't know this guy, but I just think his ego sort of got in the way. And he's like going up against Belichick, and, you know, we're going to keep them from winning their fifth Super Bowl and Brady winning his. And, yeah, I just think he sort of got caught up in the whole thing, and his whole ego and macho kind of attitude sort of got in the way of clear thinking. But that's my opinion. So
it's understandable, and I would say that I think a lot of people agree with you. I mean, I'm looking at the play-by-play. First and 10 from the New England 22. This is when Atlanta, you think, at least walks away with a field goal attempt. I mean, they ran the ball on that first down. Freeman lost the yard. So it's second and 11. Yeah. You say, you know, maybe come back with another run. And then on third down, if you want to throw it, fine. But, you know, he gets sacked, Matt Ryan. And why did he get sacked? Keep in mind, Mark, because Devontae Freeman, who was there to block Hightower, completely broke down and missed his assignment. And then on the next play, Matthews, their offensive lineman, gets called for a hold. But here's the thing, and I've told this to a lot of people. Even if they run the football on that play, Paul, Jake Matthews could still be called for a hold too. Just because you throw the football doesn't mean you can't be called for a holding call. Holding calls could easily come on running plays. So I think there's multiple ways to look at it.
I was going to say, I just think the formation. I mean, how many times do we see the shotgun draw on the Giants this year? They could have had a guy in the backfield to pick up a blitz, or instead of putting him where he was. I just think it was very arrogant. But anyway, that's my opinion. The other conversation that I think John and Paul had last week is about the most exciting Super Bowls. And it got me thinking about the Giants' five NFC championships. And they were all exciting, obviously, because we went to the Super Bowl. But I'd like to get your take on what you think was the most exciting. In my opinion, it was 1990 when the Giants went out to San Francisco. They had Jeff Hostetler, quarterbacking. The 49ers were 14-2, going for the three-peat. I mean, there were awesome plays on defense. You had the Gary Reasons fake punt. I mean, I just think all in all, when you guys define what was an exciting game, that to me was the most exciting from start to finish, as you defined it. So I'd like to get your opinion. I'll listen to it off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate you
weighing in. That's a very fair comment. And again, it goes back to how do you define a great game or an exciting game or a dramatic game? See, to me, that four-letter word game is a whole lot different than the F word that says finish. A great finish does not an exciting game make. It's a big difference for me. So I'm on board with that perspective for sure.
I'm just glad you kept the PG-13 with the F word. So when you threw that out, I wasn't sure what direction you're going in.
Thank you for that. Finish. Those are the two F words that came to mind for me.
All
I don't know about you.
I don't know. Maybe I headed a different direction. That's how my brain works. And I would agree with you in terms of your sentiment that it's one thing to say you had a great fourth quarter. You had a great final 15 minutes. Another thing to say that from the minute the game kicked off to the end, that it was a real solid contest. And I'll actually take a page out of Mark's playbook. You know, I go back to the 2011 NFC Championship game between the Giants and the Niners, a different matchup.
Phenomenal game.
I mean, that to me is one of those games that stands out, that you're at the edge of your seat. It's so physically demanding, a grinded-out type of game. It was raining. Eli Manning took his fair share of hits, special teams mishaps. I mean, that game had everything.
I'm going to go with two things. We'll go with Dave's thought last week about if the game was on Classic, would you rewatch the whole game in its entirety or would you just watch the last 20 minutes? I think that's a great litmus test. The other great litmus test is, as the game is happening, do you feel as though you can get up from your seat to go to the kitchen or to go to the bathroom? For whatever reason, the wife comes in with the groceries. Can you go help her out with the packages? No. I have to sit here and see every snap because this game is just so compelling. I can't miss one snap. That makes a great game.
Well, I'm in agreement with you. I think that you do have to take into consideration, did the game have a flash or did the game have multiple flashes? And to use this last Super Bowl as an example, Super Bowl 51, who a lot of people are already ranking as the greatest Super Bowl ever, it was the first Super Bowl that ever went to overtime. And I get it. I understand that there's some substance to make that number one. But aside from the fourth quarter and the first drive of overtime, because that's all that was overtime, the game was lopsided. It wasn't an edge-of-the-seat type of thriller. So if you're going to look at it from that criteria, I find it very difficult to move that to number one. And I know that John brought this up, and I think the two of you went back and forth with John Clayton's list on ESPN, where he ranked every single one of the Super Bowls, all 51. He put 51 atop the list, and then number two was Giants-Bills. Well, Giants-Bills, though, from start to finish, was an extremely competitive affair. It was much more competitive than 51. I mean, I would also throw out Patriots-Seahawks to me from start to finish. I know that Seattle went ahead, but that was at least much more back and forth. You know, you look at the two Giants-Patriots Super Bowls, you put those up there. How about Cardinals-Steelers? Cardinals-Steelers was a great game, too.
And some great plays. Santonio Holmes, James Harrison. I mean, come on. You know, there were...
But that brings up another good point, Paul, because I think if you're going to label it as the greatest Super Bowl, not only does it have to be a competitive game, but I think you have to have some noteworthy, game-changing types of plays.
That too, no question.
And you can't just have maybe one. I mean, to me, you have to have at least some multiple or choices to at least go by to say this is why this game stands out. I mean, the Giants-Patriots games, multiple plays. Steelers-Cardinals, multiple plays. Patriots-Seahawks had multiple plays.
I mean, like I said, those games, if you blinked, you felt like you missed something. I didn't feel that way about this past Super Bowl. You could have not seen the first three quarters and woken up from a stupor in the fourth and seen the best parts of that game.
Well, it's convenient for you. I mean, the first three quarters, you could have started breaking down film for what to expect for 2017.
I could have been on a walk.
Exactly. You could have been on a Nike walk, too. Well, but Nike walks are productive for you because you're very versatile on those Nike walks. You tweet, you run. I don't think you get enough credit for what you're able to accomplish on that. 201-939-4513 is the telephone number. Hashtag Giants Chat. Freddie is in New Jersey. Freddie, what's happening?
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
With the NFL Combine coming up, I just want to throw a player out there for you guys to watch for, tight end at University of Miami, David Njoku. Everybody's talking about Howard and the kid Everett from South Alabama.
I know of him.
And what do you think about maybe taking him at 23?
You know, my opinion on taking a tight end at 23 is going to be different than a lot of other people's because I believe that there are a lot of tight ends in this draft. And much as I felt a few years ago about receivers, you can get a functional one and a good one in the later rounds. My priorities would not be to take a tight end, but that's just – and that has nothing to do with the player. I think he's a quality player, but I'm not taking a tight end at 23.
Okay, all right. He's saying he can run a 4.4, so we'll see what he can do at the combine. I'm sure he's going to do great and everything, but like you said, this is a deep tight end draft.
It is.
That's my.
And the question, if you're the Giants, is as you look at the tight end spot, are you looking to draft more of a blocker or are you looking to draft more of a receiver, depending upon what you think you're going to do with Jarrell Adams? How are you going to use Will Johnson? Is Will Johnson healthy coming off of a year on IR? You got to figure out how those puzzle pieces fit before you decide exactly what kind of tight end you want to bring in here. And if you're going to bring in more of a blocking tight end, you definitely get one later in the draft.
Yeah,
you don't draft high for that.
You do not need to spend a first-round pick on that. And it goes back to, and I'm not saying that there's not room for a tight end to thrive in this offense, Freddie, but it goes back to the rationale, as Jerry Reese explained why they didn't bring in another fullback after Will Johnson got hurt, is because they looked at the playbook and the offense and they said it doesn't warrant a roster spot because we're not going to use Will Johnson enough. So, you know, you also have to make sure if you're going to spend a first-round pick on a tight end, it's got to be a two-way tight end, and it's got to be a tight end that's going to be heavily involved in the offense because you want immediate impact. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm bringing up the 2015 draft because I think it's way too early to evaluate this past year's draft. In 2015, no tight ends were taken in the first round. The first tight end that went was in the second round. Baltimore, with the 55th overall pick in 2015, took Max Williams out of Minnesota. I mean, they have a variety of tight ends. Max Williams, I mean, 2 years now in the league. Has Max Williams been a huge difference maker for the Baltimore Ravens? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people haven't even heard of him. Then the next
The
next one went in the third round, 68th overall pick. The Raiders took Clive Walford. Clive's had some flashes for Oakland, but not nearly.
But nothing spectacular.
So, I mean, you got to look at it from that perspective, I think.
Yeah, I just like him a lot, and I just think he'll make a big impact on this offense. So we'll see what happens. Like you said, we just got to wait and see how everything plays out. So.
Absolutely.
All right, thank you guys for taking my call.
You got it, Freddie.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate the phone call. You know who comes to mind in this conversation, Paul? And I remember the year that he was available, Giants fans were pushing for the team to draft him, Eric Ebron. Because Eric Ebron, to me, is the last tight end that went fairly high in terms of recent drafts that I can remember off the top of my head. And, you know, a lot of the Giants fans, they felt Eric Ebron could be a big playmaker, bring him in. And, you know, unfortunately, he's dealt with some injuries over his career. But, I mean, even if you're the Lions, if you could go back I'm sure Detroit may have taken a guy that could have had a little bit more of an impact, especially maybe on the defensive end or the offensive line, to help them in other areas than necessarily what Eric Ebron has brought to the table. And it's nothing against Eric Ebron as a player. I mean, you can't foresee what's going to happen with the injury bug. But tight end, it really depends on how you use that position, more so than what the player brings to the table. The player could be dynamic, but if you're not going to utilize him in ways that you can maximize his value, to me, it's very difficult to then use a first-round pick on that position.
Well, of course, because as we all know, first-round picks, I mean, the value that is inherent in them is not just a guy who's going to play a big role in your offense, but or your defense for that matter, but he's going to be not just good, but really good. Not just play a big role, but he's going to be like a Pro Bowl caliber kind of player. And the other thing is, quite frankly, you have to look at your team and say, well, where are the holes also? And I know that they always say best player available. And yes, best player available is important. But if you look at the holes on your team, and then you look at the depth of the draft, and this year, tight end is deep. There's a lot of pass catchers. There are even a bunch of blockers. You got to say to yourself, well, now, priority-wise, if you're going to be able to get one in the second or third round, you can't be reaching and jumping ahead and grabbing one around early.
Well, that goes back to value, like you said. If there's not nearly as much depth at another position that you need, but there's plenty of depth at tight end,
if you don't grab one of those other guys now, there's not going to be anybody.
Because you're not going to have any substance in the later rounds.
They're not going to be
there. You need a position or a player at that position that's going to be impactful. So I agree with you. I mean, you certainly need to take that into consideration as well. All right, let's head back to the phone lines. Wow, how about this? We got Jay in Turkey. Jay, welcome to the program. What's happening?
Wow.
Hey, what's going on, guys? I called from England the last time. I'm in the military. I move around.
Well, we thank you for your service, Jay. Appreciate that.
Nah, thank you. So, Lance, if you could do me a favor, man, I just check NFL.com. You'll probably see some Giants news that maybe I want to talk about. But my question is for Paul. How are we really drafting best player available? Because when we drafted David Wilson back then, there was the two tight ends were still available in Kobe Fleener and Dwayne Allen, and we needed a tight end at that time. And then also when we drafted Pugh, the best tight end of the ice was still available, and we went with Pugh. So I know, like Jerry Reese always says, hey, we're drafting best player available. Are we truly drafting best player available, or are we drafting best need at that time?
No, best player available is still the prevailing wisdom with this organization, but there's no question that the need component is part of the equation. I will tell you this, when they drafted David Wilson, what they thought they were going to get was an incredible athlete with rare speed, cutting, and acceleration ability that would be a potent weapon coming out of the backfield. If not running the ball, certainly being able to catch it out of the backfield. They had tremendous hopes for him. And if you watched him when he first got here to the Giants, his quickness and explosion was really something to behold. I mean, what he'd do on kickoff returns when they worked him in quickly into the lineup as a rookie, his kickoff returns was spectacular. He had physical skills and tools. Of course, you know, he got hurt, unfortunately, and that was the end of that. But I understand what they saw there. They saw some very rare tools that, you know, they hadn't had in this locker room for many a year. So, and as far as Pugh was concerned, when they drafted Pugh, they knew they needed somebody who was going to be able to compete at tackle. So that need did come into play. But when they drafted him, I was told that they had a very high grade on him, thinking that he would be a very, very, very good NFL guard. And they were forcing him to play tackle out of need early in his career. Yeah. But this is a guy who they had very high marks on. So I'm not going to dispute that he was not high on their board. I won't do that because, quite frankly, if you remember going into that draft, Pugh was on my radar for the Giants.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just say that because, like, now we're having these issues with tight end. And ever since Jeremy Shockey left, we've kind of been, you know, moonlighting in that position, getting people in and out, in and out, in and out. We never really had solidified positions at tight end. And we had two drafts where we could have drafted at least one, a serviceable tight end, and one the best. And I've seen them on time. in Eifert. Also, Paul, you said something, and this I'll take this off the line. You said that I've seen a lot of fans of multiple drafts. There's a lot of Cowboys fans in the military. Let me just let you guys know that. I don't know why, but there's a lot of Cowboys fans in the military. And I've always told them that there is an anti-New York bias. I don't know why. I do not know what the reason is. And it also speaks to Eli as well. Eli doesn't get a lot of credit due for what he has done in his career. I think also just the anti-bias. We talk about that. I'll take it off the line. Thanks.
All right, appreciate the phone call.
Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks so much for chiming in, Jay.
Did he say he was part of the service or was talk to servicemen?
No, he is in the service.
He is in the
That's
service.
That's why he's been moving around from England
so,
to Turkey.
So please, yeah. Thank you very much for your service, and I never let that go by without saying that to all of our military because we do appreciate and understand what you guys go through. So thank you. In reference to your question, I don't think there's any doubt that New York – faces an anti-bias from around the rest of the country. When you look at how long it took guys like Wellington Mara and Harry Carson to get into the Hall of Fame, that is quite apparent. You know, it's just the way it is. Eli Manning has certainly caught his share of critics. I just saw the other day, what was it? NFL.com or Pro Football Reference or Pro Football Focus? Some organization did some kind of mathematical computations and came up with a percentage chance that some of today's superstars would have in terms of being elected into the Hall of Fame. Eli Manning was rated at 72% chance of getting in. I think it's higher than that. I think he is a Hall of Famer, but 72% chance says to me he's going to get in. I think that number's high enough where you could say he's going to make it. For me, it wouldn't even be a question. But I do appreciate your sentiment, and I do think that there is a certain amount of anti-New York out there, no doubt.
All right, let's head back to the phone lines at 201-939-4513. Thanks so much for tuning in to Monday's edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live. He's Paul Dottino. I'm Lance Meadow. We got Steve in D.C. Steve, what's happening?
Hey, what's going on, fellas?
Doing well, Steve.
Appreciate y'all taking my call.
Well, thanks for making it. Long time no hear. How's everything?
No, I listen. You know, first I wanted to touch back on Landon Collins, man, because I remember hearing him saying that he had worked with, I think it was Ryan Clark from the ex Steeler, you know, and I think whatever he did in the offseason, you know, other than his own, you know, talent, man, really helped him grow, you know, this last offseason. So, I can't really, you know, say how happy I was with Landon Collins on and off the field. I just like the way the kid carried himself. So, you know, did you guys hear about how he gave a lot of his development to Ryan Clark?
That is true.
Yeah.
Ryan Clark was also a former Giant, if you'll remember, early in his career, and also a Redskin at one point.
Yeah, I don't remember. Sadly enough, I don't remember him as a Giant. I remember him as a Redskin. When was he a Giant? What year was that, Paul?
He was Giant early
very,
in his career.
At the very beginning of his career. He was what I would consider to be a very inconsistent young safety who had a lot to learn when he was with New York. And then, of course, later on wound up honing his skills and did much better with the Redskins and then seemed to even become better when he got to the Steelers. I thought this is a guy who was a late bloomer, one of those late blossoming guys like Jonathan Casillas, who you didn't think much of necessarily earlier in his years, but then seemed to get it.
Yeah, he was with the Giants in 2002 and 2003. 2002, he was mainly on the practice squad. 2003, he actually started four games and was a key contributor also on special teams.
And then specials.
He had two stints with the Redskins because he finished his career with the Redskins in 14 after having a stint with the Steelers. So, yeah, he was in the league for a good decade.
Cool. Hey, listen. First of all, I read an article that has me a little bit giddy. I don't know about how other Giants fans are going to take it, but I couldn't be happier. Just the thought of it just has me giddy. And I'm sure you guys are familiar with Bucky Brooks. And I'm wondering if you've seen the article where he was saying that he felt like Deshaun Watson, the quarterback from
Clemson,
could fall right, you know, there for us, and would obviously I think be good, perfect fit, you know, in a couple of years, you know, to take over for Eli. But you know, with that said, he was showing how you know we could easily free up about $17 million, and there's a possibility we can make a bigger splash in the free agency than what people are thinking. I'm hoping that you know we can get Whitworth and just kind of you know fill in the left tackle and let those guys compete. You know, Barbie Hart and you know and Flowers compete on the right. So I just want to know what your guys think is, because let me tell you something. I think he's the perfect successor. I would love to see him sitting there for a couple of years and learning behind Eli, learning this offense. I mean, is it a possibility? I mean, where is this? Because I'll tell you, I'm very excited about the notion. If that would have happened, oh my gosh. What do you guys think about that?
Well, if Watson's projected to go in the first round, then that means you're using your first round pick to get him if he perhaps falls to the Giants.
Between the first and second round.
But let's go with the first round, because I think most people are under the assumption that he's going to go in the first round. So it goes back to the conversation, Steve, that Paul and I just had when two callers ago asked about the tight end position and whether or not you're maximizing the value of that first round pick if you take a tight end in the first round. So if you use your first round pick on a quarterback who you know is not going to play for at least the next 2 to 3 years, are you truly maximizing the value of your first round pick?
I believe so, yeah. In this case, yeah. If you take care of your business with the left tackle position, absolutely, he's worth it. I mean, I just feel like, hands down, yeah. I mean, I thought about it. Definitely, I would feel comfortable giving up that pick. You know, as long as we handle that left tackle position, because, you know, I don't know what you were thinking in the first round. I'd love to hear about it. But, even if he wasn't there first round, I'm thinking, first round would probably be, it's not going to be, likely probably not going to be an offensive lineman. So it'll probably be a defensive end or a defensive tackle. And I feel like with the $17 million, we can make that happen along with the left tackle. So I feel like we could get a lot done in the free agency. So I think it's a very likely possibility that it would be, it would be possible. I think we could get our needs taken care of and make that happen. Is it not, you don't think so?
Well, I mean, it depends on what happens with, obviously, Hankins and JPP and, some of their other targets in free agency. To me, the draft is so valuable because of the fact that, you're going to get the guy on a rookie contract. You're going to have him for 4 years with an option for a fifth if he's your first-round pick. And, I mean, you could develop him along the way, and he's not really going to put such a big dent into the finances that you're dedicating towards him. So, I mean, I look at it as if you're going to use your first-round pick, you would assume you want that guy to come in year one, and he's going to contribute immediately, not necessarily being a guy that Eli Manning is going to mentor.
Well, with a quarterback, I don't know. Aaron Rodgers was picked in the first round, wasn't he?
He was, absolutely. I mean, listen, every team is different, but remember, you're talking about the Packers have consistently made the playoffs, even going back to when Brett Favre was under center. So, that's a team that has not really missed a beat. Whereas the Giants, they just finished a period of time where they didn't make the playoffs, and their goal is, with the nucleus of this defense, they want to now continue to get back there and not have, interruptions every 4 years or so.
Well, listen, I'll say this and I'll get off real quick. 11-5, I feel like we're only one or two pieces away. With $17 million, I think we could easily free up. I think it's very possible for us to do it if we chose to do it. Last thing I'll say before I get off on is everybody who is in the Hall of Fame really needs to take a stand, because I don't even want to talk about the Hall of Fame if T.O. is not in it. I'm not a T.O. fan, but to me, anybody could talk about that and not say that T.O. needs to be in there. Honestly, I have no words for you. It's absolutely ridiculous. This man is not in the Hall of Fame. Appreciate you guys taking my call. Great show, and I'll listen off air. Thanks, guys.
You got it, Steve. Thanks for making the phone call. Man, we brought that up last week. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I don't think there's anything else you can say at this point.
I let you take care of that because I've already spoken to it ad infinitum.
Well, so have I. And, I mean, the only thing that I'll rehash in case the callers did not hear last week is the fact that if you look at him from a statistical standpoint, and numbers are important when you consider Hall of Famers, Terrell Owens and the three most important characteristics of a receiver: receptions, receiving yards, and touchdowns. No, I mean, those are the three things that we look at, right, for a receiver? He is in the top 10 in NFL history in all three of those categories. So I really don't think there needs to be anything else said than just to make the point that he's in the top 10 in NFL history. So I think the prosecution rests its case. With that being said, let's head back to the phone lines. We got Oliver in Denver. Oliver, what's happening?
Hey, good to talk to you guys, Lance and Paul.
Hi.
I don't miss many shows, but I catch you guys a lot online. But I'm glad I got you guys both on today. Just quick question, not to dig too much back in the last season in Super Bowl, but congrats to the Patriots. I know Paul would know this answer. How did Bill Belichick never become the Giants head coach?
George Young, when he was GM of the Giants and Bill Parcells was the Giants head coach and Bill Belichick was their defensive coordinator, had in his mind not believed that at the time Belichick had the proper characteristics to be the head coach of the Giants here in New York. The various circumstances involved, whether it be managing the entire locker room as personalities, whether it be handling the New York media and the pressures of trying to follow Bill Parcells, or just flat out the heat that the New York media can provide. There are a lot of intangibles that George was just unsure of with Bill Belichick at that time. And as you know, Belichick's first head coaching job in Cleveland did not go well. It did not go well at all, as a matter of fact.
No.
It was pretty bad. So, you know, I think in retrospect, you could probably say that George was right at that time. Bill Belichick may not have been the right guy to become the Giants head coach. And, you know, of course, years later, as things developed, he went with Parcells to the Jets and then wound up going to New England. So I think the timing, probably more than anything else, was just really bad for fate to have that happen. And, you know, that's why he is where he is. But think about this for a second, if you will. The Giants organization, I think, has more ties to the Super Bowl than any other organization in the National Football League. When you consider Coughlin, Belichick, Lombardi, Landry, Fox went to a Super Bowls, Peyton, okay? I mean, the list is just, it just keeps going on and on and on and on. As people who were part of a Giants staff who wound up coaching in a Super Bowl. I mean, there's a long list there. I think they are probably the most represented team if you just consider the coaching tree in Super Bowl history.
Yeah, especially if you include Landry as well.
You have to.
So I got a question about, you know, I listen to you a lot, and I know you want to fix the trenches. Hypothetically speaking, if we fix the trenches and say we bring back a veteran blocking tight end, I won't mention no name, he played in the Super Bowl. If we go into the draft, if a running back lands in the first round and is the top two or three running back, do we not take him? If he's the best player available.
Well, I think it depends on how great that running back is. How far ahead is he of other players on the board. I'll give you a great example, okay? Ezekiel Elliott was by far the best running back going into this year's draft. Everybody knew he could potentially be a franchise back. And then there was quite a drop-off on everybody else's running back chart after Ezekiel Elliott. Now, if that's the case, if they get to 23 and there's a running back there who is that far ahead of everybody else, well, then you have to think about it, especially since the Giants are probably going to retool their running back core this season. I think that's fair to say. So you probably would think about it. But now, if that running back is almost neck and neck with an offensive lineman or with a pass rusher, I'm kind of inclined to go the other way. You know, I would go with the offensive lineman or the pass rusher. You know, I think the only way you can go with the running back is if he is that far ahead on your best player available board, and he's just a can't-miss franchise guy. And I don't know that you're going to get one of those at 23. And quite frankly, I'm of the belief you can get the kind of back the Giants would need later on. You've heard me talk about P. Ryan from Oklahoma maybe in the third round. You know, I think I'd be very happy with that.
I would be happy with that, and if we add a power back to go along with Perkins, I think we'll have that good combination of kind of like Bradshaw Jacobs, and those guys weren't high draft picks. But I just kind of see the predictability we had these last few seasons. You got Vereen in, so you know it's probably a third down. You got Perkins in, which is the least predictable. You got Jennings in, who might do a draw. So if you bring one of those guys in and get away from this committee and go more towards one lead back guy, I think we become less predictable and maybe extend Eli's career a little bit more by having a good power game and taking the pressure off of Beckham to do all the weightlifting for the offense. But it makes good sense. We got to just kind of see how the draft board shakes down. But I do think maybe one of those top two or three guys that might be a franchise, the McCaffreys, the Fournettes, and the Dalvin Cooks, they may fall in our laps at 23. But that's good thinking. Thanks for the information. Enjoy listening, you guys.
All right, Alva. Appreciate the phone call. I mean, I think in this day and age, you know, most running backs – or I should say most backfields, need versatility. It's very rare that one team relies on one guy, especially in this day and age compared to what we've seen in previous seasons. I know Elliott's an exception, and Adrian Peterson in his heyday were exceptions, but most backfields, you got two-headed monsters, or you have one guy who's a bruiser and a complimentary back and so forth. That certainly has been the trend. All right, well, with that being said, that is going to wrap up our coverage here on Big Blue Kickoff Live for Monday's edition. Big Blue Kickoff Live with you each and every weekday, the rest of the week at noon Eastern. Certainly appreciate everybody tuning in. We'll try to address some of your tweets off the air. For Paul Dottino, I'm Lance Meadow. Enjoy the rest of your Monday right here on Giants.com.